It is a happy privilege of mine to present our worship leader for today, the Reverend R.S. Smith, Jr., pastor of the First Baptist Church of Durham. Mr. Smith is a native of Lenoir, a graduate of Mars Hill College and Wake Forest University. He received the Bachelor of Divinity degree from this seminary in 1957. He was on this campus both when the college was here and then among the early classes of Southeastern Seminary. During the time he was a student here, he was pastor of the Kennedy Home Baptist Church in Kinston, where he served as pastor to the children of one of our North Carolina Baptist children's homes. After receiving his Bachelor of Divinity degree, he went to the town of Pittsboro in this state, where he served as pastor of the Pittsboro Baptist Church from 1957 through 1961. In 1961, he changed pastorates to the First Baptist Church of North Wilkesboro, where he had a six-year pastorate. For the past 2.5 years, he has been pastor of the First Baptist Church in Durham. I've had the opportunity to visit Mr. Smith in each of his pastorates, to observe his work, and to have the opportunity to fellowship with him, to hear him talk about his people and his work. And I've also heard members of his church talk about him and his dynamic leadership. He has been effective as a pastor in this state. His service is broader than service to the local church, however. He has served the North Carolina Baptist State Convention in many different ways on various committees. Currently, he is a member of the General Board of the Baptist State Convention and a member of the Executive Committee of that board. He is also chairman of the Council on Christian Education. He has served as the director of the Biblical Recorder and many other places of service in the North Carolina Baptist State Convention life. Beyond that, he is a member of the Executive Committee of the Southern Baptist Convention. I believe that in the history of this school, we have had 2 graduates of our school to serve on the Executive Committee of the Southern Baptist Convention, and Mr. Smith is currently serving on that group. He is chairman of the Administrative Committee of the Executive Committee of the SBC. I present him to you this morning as a friend of mine, a friendship dating back to our student days at Southeastern Seminary, a close personal friend. Our families have exchanged visits and meals. We have shared together many happy times and a few unhappy times. Not only do I present him as a friend of mine, but I present him as a friend of this seminary. We appreciate his including us on his schedule and coming to be our worship leader today, Mr. Smith.
In the days of doctrinal readers, it's not an asset, perhaps, to be associated with the Executive Committee of the Southern Baptist Convention. I suppose that as a guest speaker, I ought to say it's a privilege and a pleasure to stand in this pulpit. I'm not going to say that, but rather to say that it's comforting, not comfortable, but comforting, to stand here because I know that all gross errors will be properly corrected after our session together, because there's a lot of learning here in this community and fellowship of learning. The reason, I think, is because of what Dr. Hubert Petit said, that great mind and spirit who literally presided at Wake Forest for 40-odd years in the classroom. He said the reason we have so much education at Wake Forest is because the freshmen bring so much in and the seniors take so little away. And I suppose that tradition is still carried on here at Wake Forest. But I know also that we have 2 interns on our staff at Durham who are members of the student body, and they constantly and consistently keep my theology updated and straight. Someone wanted to know why we call them interns. Well, that was their decision. On our first staff meeting, they wanted to know what they would be called, assistants or associates. I told them that made no difference to me whatsoever. They could be called what they wanted to. We were going to abbreviate it the same way. They chose interns. In all seriousness, I'm grateful for Southeastern Seminary, for what it has meant to me, what it is meaning to me. It's a very human institution, and I know that. That's the reason I can love it and be loved by it. And I'm grateful for it, for you. About 2 summers ago, our family had the privilege of spending a week in the restful and remote and relaxing mountains of our state. In this relaxed state, we forgot, among other things, to wind our watches. So along about the middle of the week, our watches stopped. We had no radio nor telephone, for which we were grateful, only a television set. But did you know they never give the time of day on a television set? Oh, they'll give you station identification every 30 minutes. But they never give you the time of day. I didn't realize that until our watches had stopped and we had no earthly idea what time it was. So we sat there trying to find out what time it was. We sat through soap operas and fourth-rate daytime westerns. The cartoons, we saw murder and immorality and comedy. We saw the works. But we never found out what time it was. We were never given the time of day, that needed point of reference around which we could organize and order our lives. This is almost a basic parable of life. We live right in the middle of the hard sell commercial. Victims of Madison Avenue specialists for our attention and our dollar. We live in a soap opera world filled with frustrated fictions, distorted but real problems, which involve less fiction and more fact than we dare admit. We live in a world where gun smoke is real except for the setting, where Mission Impossible is possibly going on in dead earnest, and where we laugh in to keep from crying, and where hee-haw is welcome because perhaps we've forgotten how to get rid of a good belly laugh. It's our world of the comic and the cynical and crime. It's our society of drugs and DTs and dirty dishes. It's our generation of gaps and gapes and apes. It's our niche in history where copping out and coping with is spelled almost alike except for a split pea of a difference by different people for unlike reasons. It's a world in which immorality has been renamed morality by amoral philosophers. It's an atmosphere where pornographic literature finds wide acceptance in the name of sophistication, and where premarital sex is a substitute for the diamond ring as a symbol of love and a lot more expensive when the final bill comes in, and where extramarital affairs and sex is sanctioned as a symbol of freedom for the individual. Now, into this fantasy-filled and fantastically exciting world, a world of wild extremes and extremes of the wild, a world of muddled thinking and intellectual thought, a world of gadgets designed to save time and more time begged to design more gadgets to save more time. Into our world, which is on the brink of all sorts of scientific and intellectual and inventive breakthroughs and discoveries, someone, somewhere, somehow, sometime has got to give more than a station identification. Somebody's got to say what time it is. Someone has got to give a point of reference which will let us order and organize our lives and find some kind of purpose in it all. And as I see it, the Christian church has such a responsibility. To be more specific, you and I as God's ministers, your church and my church, somewhere along the line, we've got to say what time it is. I think our generation is simply tired of our station identifications. In a world that is so well symbolized by TV programming, about all we've been doing has been to insert station identifications between programs and commercials. We can tell who we are, we can tell what we have been, we can identify ourselves as the church. But the actors in the drama, even the silent majority, sitting as spectators, which the word SM implies, in its tube TV-like world, they're asking, so what? I don't care who you are. I don't care what you've been. What I'm wanting to know is, what time is it? Give me some kind of point of reference that will make sense out of this Humpty Dumpty topsy-turvy world I'm caught in. Now, I know they're not yelling it that plainly and couched in that language, but every inhuman act by human people, every act that takes away from human dignity, every venture in which we get involved which makes us less human, is that question and that cry, regardless of the language it's couched in. And we, the church, have got to answer, if we've got the answer. I think we must give two times, both of them Greek words, and this will give me a chance to let you know I took Greek when I was here. Loved it when I took it, but after 14 years, I comfort myself in the words of the poet, 'tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. One is chronos, from which we get chronometer, clock, the root word for our word chronology. It means time in the sense of a specific time of day. The other is kairos, time in the sense of season, to put it too simply. Now, as I see it, the church has a responsibility to sound forth on both of these times. We must set forth the kairos, the situation of our day and our age and generation. We simply must know what's going on, what kind of time it is that we're living in. We can't stick our heads in the sand of churchy business and pretend that our world is all right and that we have no word to speak and no deed to perform. Jesus leveled the indictment at the professional religionists of his day. He said to them, when it's evening, you say it'll be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning it will be foul weather for today, for the sky is red and lowering. Oh, you hypocrites, you masked actors. You can't discern the face of the sky. You can discern the face of the sky, but you can't discern the signs of the time. I think we as the church must be able to discern the signs of the time. That's part of our job, perhaps our job. The church must not only be militant. You know, it's getting increasingly difficult to use that word, isn't it, in the context of the church today? But the church has always been militant when the church has been great. The church must not only be militant, she must be prophetic. And a prophet is a person who knows the situation of his day, who knows the forces that are at work in his generation, and who, under the leadership of God, can put two and two together and get four and say the time is four or this. Elizabeth Barrett Browning said of Thomas Carlyle, that he knocked out a window in the blind wall of his century. And through that window, he saw in new perspective the portents and personalities of his time. And consequently, he spoke to his contemporaries with a vehemence and authority in what Mrs. Browning called soul, S-O-U-L, language. The church today must knock out a window in the blind wall of its generation and speak with authority as to the time of day it is. There are three books which every minister ought to wear out from usage: the Bible, the newspaper, if I may call that a book, and the telephone directory. These three books ought to be worn out by every serious Christian in our churches, if we're to be the church. The newspaper, read with discernment, literally is our source of information in our day and generation. The phone book is our link with persons and our personal relationships. The newspaper is the event or the events. The telephone book is persons to whom events happen or persons who are making events happen. The Bible is God's word both on the events and to the persons, giving guidance to the persons as they try to make sense with and out of the events of our day. And if we're to tell the time, the kairos, to our generation, these three books are required daily reading. We, the church, must have and set forth the kairos and then the chronos, the specific time of history of our generation. A popular magazine following the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima had on its front cover a picture of a clock. Underneath the caption, "The Clock of Civilization," the hands of the clock were at 5 minutes to 12. Following the explosion of the H-bomb, the same magazine had the same clock, same caption, with one exception. The hands had been moved to 2 minutes till 12. I don't know where the hands are exactly right now, whether still at 2 or have they moved closer. But as Albert Einstein said, it's simply too late to make mistakes. I think the church must know this, that it's too late to make mistakes, and proclaim that the hour is late, that it's simply too late to make mistakes. The church must never use scare tactics, certainly, but she must be tactical enough and be diligent enough in her mission that she may not even at this late hour have the luxury of being tactful. There must be a sense of urgency in her voice. She must proclaim with prophetic voice that the time is late, and with redemptive voice she must announce that the time is now. She must say to her world, "We are living in the eternal now." From the New Testament writers, she must redemptively proclaim and lovingly set forth that now is the accepted time. Now the Spirit of God is near. Now the hour of salvation is upon us. It's always a now, now, now situation with the church. This sense of urgency must never leave nor be separated from our sense of mission. It is in mankind's history too late to make a mistake in our mission, too late to make a mistake in race relations, too late to make a mistake in correcting social evils and in dealing injustice a death blow. It's simply too late to make a mistake in closing the gaps of our generations, the generation gap, the communication gap, the gap between biblical teaching and Christian living, the gap between private morals and public causes. It's simply too late to make mistakes. I feel and I believe that if we, the church, drop the ball on these 70-yard lines, these years of the 70s, if we fumble that ball in the next 5 to 10 years, it can be all over for the Christian church as we know her. The local church that does not get with it in the next 5 to 10 years, that does not find out what time it is and speak that time in no uncertain sounds, may be doomed, damned, and dead. But on the other side, the bright side of the coin, I think I see a promised land, because there's always been a promised land for God's people when they followed him. I believe that we stand on this side of our Jordan. We've been fed with God's manna. Water has gushed from many a barren rock to quench the thirst of God's people. And now we stand on our side of our Jordan. Our Jordan River of swirling currents and all sorts of currents and cross currents. And the river lies before us. The scouts have gone out and they've come back. There, as always, are two reports. One tells us to turn back, to go back to Egypt, back to the old ways and back to the old days. There are giants out there, they tell us, and they'll kill us off. But there are other voices. And I find myself with this group, which would say we are well able to overcome. Let us go and take the promised land. Now is the time. That's what time it is. It's time to go forward, to move out and to take the land and the day that God has promised. And in the words of that great old hymn, sung at every graduation of Wake Forest University in this chapel for years, in the words of that old hymn, "Lead on, O King Eternal, the day of march is come. Henceforth in fields of conquest, thy tents shall be our home. Through days of preparation, thy grace has made us strong. And now, O King Eternal, we lift our battle song." Fellow Christians, that's what time it is. And let us move and not be afraid. Let us pray. God, give us the wisdom to know how to move, the courage to know when to move, and the good sense to listen to you.